welcome to another episode of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And we're going to continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. When I visited Goa, India in 1994 on one of the best assignments I ever got as a journalist, I went there to cover the budding underground electronic dance scene, the very scene that birthed psytrance, now one of the major mutant strains of electronic music around the world. And it was a marvelous opportunity to see, kind of tune into early 90s freakdom, global freakdom, because there were people there from all over the world. There were British raver types, you know, since it was a few years after the UK Summer of Love. There was sort of, working class raver dudes who were there, who were great fun. And then a variety of Europeans, you know, the Germans tended to be more sort of intense and kind of sober, like they're on a very heavy, you know, sort of mystical trip there, you know, with the India and music and the sacred compounds. And then the Southern Europeans were a little more lighter. The Italians were very funny. The Spanish were very friendly. And it was just all these sort of different characters. But there was a sort of sense of different nationalities doing their alternative culture, their mystic, hedonistic, musical explorations, and it was a different kind of style. But without doubt, the most fearsome, intense, and over-the-top characters were from Israel. These guys were off the hook. They were there not just to party, not just to experience enlightenment or whatever, you know, passes as experiencing enlightenment, but really to just kind of escape something or find something that remained enigmatic to those of us who were observing and interacting with these characters. And one of the ideas that people talked about in discussing this very obvious phenomenon at the time was that a lot of these men, especially, were diving into the underground traveler scene after doing their military service, and that they were so traumatized that they just had to get off their face as quickly and enthusiastically as possible. But I never really knew. I wasn't able to communicate with the people that I met very well from Israel. So I'm very happy that today's guest, Ido Hardogson, from Israel, is a very interesting figure there in terms of writing and blogging on issues relating to psychedelic culture, media, history of technology. He's done a lot of really interesting work. I wrote a book in Hebrew called Technomysticism, a topic dear to my heart, and just came out recently with an article in the MAPS Bulletin about Set and Setting that we'll be talking about. And he's one of the characters behind Daily Psychedelic Video, which is really quite a treat online because, well, they post a psychedelic video every day. And some of them are really remarkable, and I'm a big fan of abstract animation and visionary animation, and there's all sorts of delectable items there. And so there's a lot of interesting things to talk about in terms of psychedelic culture in general, but I'm also really looking forward to getting an Israeli angle on this stuff, and I think that Ido has also embarked on a magazine as well. So we have lots of things to talk about. Before we bring him on, welcoming on our co-host, Maja Daou from sunny Los Angeles. Hi, Maja.
It's super sunny right here.
Is it toasty?
It is. It's really nice.
That's good.
You know, it's funny. I couldn't help but thinking when you're mentioning that, obviously you can't make generalizations about countries or cultures, but in my experience, every single Israeli I have met, they're intense people, you know? Like, they're always, like, all my friends that are Israeli are super, like, is on 11 all the time. And there's this weird thing that happens between a lot of the Israelis and even some of the Hasidic Jewish folks I know, where they get interested in the Indian Enlightenment stuff and culture. There's like a whole situation that is going on there. And I've, you know, been a fan of Avram Davis for a long time. I know you mentioned him in your book, The Visionary State, and kind of like how that happens. But it's always intriguing to me to see like a culture of people that are so religiously and spiritually intense, just generally like throughout history as the Israelis, to look at and combine it with other situations, like to see what other people are doing. And then on top of that, combine it in a cultural situation, like you mentioned, where everybody's kind of getting together. Those are some of my favorite things that ever happened.
Yeah, it is interesting, and you know, across the board, and again, like it is dangerous always to generalize, but you know, and especially around a society that's as various as Israel. I mean, there's a very strong, very secular world there that is not interested in the excesses of the Orthodox, and yet there's intensity, spiritual intensity there as well. So it's a really rich mix. And rather than talking about it, let's bring Ido onto the show. Welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hi.
Good. It sounds like we have a good connection here.
Hello. Yeah, I'm really honored to be talking on the show. You know, I'm a great fan of your books.
Yeah, it's really fun. It was really fun to come across your stuff. I think the first thing we corresponded a little bit around some material you put on the Daily Psychedelic video, and that was such a wonderful discovery and a great time waster for many days digging through your top 50 and really discovering. I thought I had seen a lot of this stuff, and there were so many wonderful items, and I thought, okay, here's a cool guy. And then I read your piece in the MAPS Bulletin, which I find, you know, overall as a publication, often sort of, I didn't really learn very much except for maybe some details about some of the scientific protocols, which are interesting, but I'm more interested in the kind of cultural and philosophical issues that are raised by these things. And I was really quite impressed with your piece on Set and Setting, and since, you know, we could start there, where there's a lot of topics we can talk about, but I'd love to, just dive in right there with your thesis, which is, if I get it in a little nutshell, that, you know, everyone knows that one of the, you know, the primary concepts around psychedelic use is this notion of set and setting, that the mindset you have, the environment you're in, is going to help shape what the phenomenology of the experience is. And that's true most people think about it as a kind of individual level. You know, you're in a good state of mind, you're in it with friends in the nature, or you're anxious and worried, and you're at a rave with all sorts of crazy people. Those are going to create very different kinds of environments. But you take it further and say that the very way in which people think about what these substances are, the way they categorize them, the way they put them in a box, those two are reflective of the kind of set and setting of the culture.
Right.
And you talk about, could you compare, like the main ones you're kind of comparing is the 50s environment, 1950s environment, when people were starting to really look at LSD and mescaline, and then what happens in the 1960s and how that really changes, like almost the nature of the substance itself in a really interesting way.
So what I'm looking at in my study is like basically 10 different perspectives on what LSD is or can be that were utilized in the 1950s and 1960s, and these include like the perspective by the CIA or the perspective of the military or psychotherapeutic perspectives or artistic perspectives, and each of these kind of created or recreated the effects of LSD in the shape of what these people were looking at, or what they were expecting to find, or what they were intending to find, what they were, and the kind of like things they were surrounding themselves with, like was it a church, like in the case of the Good Friday experiment, Lewis Good Friday experiment, or was it like a hospital room in a psychotomimetic experiment, which attempted to create psychosis with LSD, which of course is possible, but it's not the only thing you can do with LSD. And the amazing thing is, of course, that each of these groups kind of surmise that what they are seeing is what the stuff itself is creating. They thought they are seeing what LSD is doing, but LSD really was kind of a reflector or a mirror for all these mindsets. And the interesting thing is that LSD was used in Harvard a few years before Leary. It was used in the 50s, actually a full decade before Leary, and it was used in the area. And of course, we didn't have any of those visionary breakthroughs or any spiritual movements or anything of that sort. So, so really, what was different about LSD in the 60s was this kind of transformation that was happening in American society in general, which shaped LSD and which at the same time was fueled by LSD and the other psychedelics.
Yeah, it's a wonderful example. I mean, I know you're a student of the history of technology, and these kinds of issues come up with technology as well. And it seems like there's a tendency in the modern world part of our reductive tendency to look at the action of things as being sort of programmed, you know. So it's like the drug is going to produce these set of effects, which mm-hmm. is not that different than, say, you know, all of our habits and our health are programmed in our DNA. You know, that's a big thing that people, you know, they're looking for, like, the origins of disease, the origins of psychology in the DNA. Like, the DNA is this little technology that's produced its, you know, typing out the same results, just the way, like, the LSD is, like, it's going to make you crazy or it's going to make you see God. But in both of these situations, it seems like we're coming to see that it's the interaction of these, you know, programs and the larger social situation that really creates the effect. And it's like you can't be that reductive with these things. You have to put them in context. I mean, they're inextricable from their context. But that's a hard thing for people to think about. People don't like to think that way. They want to think that they can identify things in the world that are going to produce repeatable effects, and if you just cordon them off, then nothing's going to be challenged about the larger situation you're in. But actually, they're much more ecological than that. They much more have to do with the larger system of mind and society and pharmacology and neurology.
Right. So, like, the basic elements of seven settings, which is character and expectation and intention, or social surrounding and the physical surrounding, they are all dependent on the culture and society that one lives in. And this whole notion of magic bullet, the idea that you can ingest a substance and get a very specific effect, was just totally wrong in the case of psychedelics. And it is also, I want to argue, very wrong in many other cases, psychedelics maybe being the most explicit one. But I was really intrigued by the case of synthetic cannabinoids lately, and the way that the effects of synthetic cannabinoids, for example, have been, in my mind, constructed by society. I mean, I've been amazed at how, let's say, purists of the psychedelic experience, they usually frame, at least here in Israel, this kind of experience as very, very lowly, very of a lowly nature. And this, to my mind, this has to do a lot with the way these substances are sold, at least here, which is to young people of low cultural social classes. And I had my own experiences with those synthetic cannabinoids, and in the beginning, my own experience was shaped by those imaginings that I had about what this is. And after a while, I started experimenting with trying to, you know, influence the way I see the drug, and through it influence the kind of effect that the drug had. And I don't know, meditating with synthetic cannabinoids, and found out that they can do different stuff. And the way that people here, at least in Israel, see them is just totally dependent on this whole social metrics of where they are sold, who they are being sold to, who is selling them, and what the interests or economics around it are. So really, and I think this has to do with all sorts of drugs, with Ritalin and with the psychopharmacological industry and so on and so forth.
Yeah, it runs all the way through it. I mean, it applies to legal psychoactives just as well, and you know,
right.
Spill into discussions of placebo and expectation. I mean, it's a very weird world when you start to really look at it, because it does seem that something like magic, you know, to speak not in a supernaturalist way, but something like performance, intention, packaging, narrative, charisma, that all of these features that we associate with, you know, like with magicians or seduction, that they're actually operative on a very direct level. I mean, we think like, oh yeah, that's fine, yeah, that can affect us in some ways, but really, that in terms of the phenomenology of a lot of psychoactives, legal and underground, that these factors are in play. And then once you start thinking about the consequences of that, things become, you know, really interesting, because just as we can look at the 1950s in terms of LSD, you can look at the 1950s and say, look, these guys, they assumed it was like psychosis, so they produced these psychotic experiences, but they're also in labs where they're like, you know, making these poor people like feel like guinea pigs, and of course they're going to freak out and feel psychotic, da-da-da. But in a way, you can say the same kinds of things about the 60s experience and the notion
right.
that psychedelics have something to do with religion or with Hinduism, of all things. And you can see the same kinds of stories. And I often wonder, you know, when you, and I'm curious to hear you on this, is when you read accounts from the 50s, not of the psychotomimetic studies where they're looking at it as just a form of psychosis, but some of the early accounts around the elite worlds, around Huxley, and people who were taking it for psychological reasons and who are doing it in a spirit of exploration. There's some of these are just like these extraordinarily sort of sweet and subtle and kind of cosmic experiences, and there's not a lot of the weird, creepy, crazy, wacky kinds of stuff that you find later on in the 60s and particularly the 1970s with Robert Anton Wilson and conspiracy theories and aliens and, you know, all this kind of, like, things get sort of seemingly weirder in the field. And I look at that whole, the way in which the phenomenology of drugs changes it, I don't think it's just happening in the individual's head because of their set and setting. It almost seems like there's, like, a cultural story that's at large that shifts
right.
and changes in really subtle ways.
Right. And I think, like, for me, one of the most amazing thing was in my research was finding out that in the 1960s and 50s, psychedelic researchers were using Ritalin in order to emulate the effects of LSD when they didn't have LSD, or sometimes instead of LSD, for like a breakthrough session. And today, like in our perspective, Ritalin being like this stimulant drug that's considered to be pumped by the establishment and exactly the opposite of psychedelics in effect, the way people see today. And yet, at that time, before those dichotomous kind of structures were created, then people could think about trying to create the effects of LSD or to emulate them in patients through Ritalin.
That's amazing. Yeah, and then...
Can I ask you, do you know if there was any placebo study similar to that that would just use nothing at all, or was it specific to only using Ritalin?
Excuse me?
Was there any placebo studies at the same time that found that they could achieve that with no drugs at all, or was it only for the Ritalin?
Well, I think like the Ritalin studies, they it wasn't around the notion of placebo. It was just as kind of an additional kind of treatment. But I'm not aware that it was used as kind of a placebo.
Mm. Then, so now one interesting spin on this, I think, is that, you know, there's so much happening in psychedelic research now, and we're really seeing the rise of a kind of, you know, psychological and medical model as official above ground studies occur, both in terms of, you know, everything from end of life to neuropharmacology to, you know, fMRI studies of neural patterns in relationship to psychedelics. You know, it's really a very rich and exciting time. And at the same time, as that goes forward, that social story is changing before our eyes. I mean, in some ways, the familiar associations of psychedelics, hippies, the Grateful Dead, tie-dye shirts, cosmic oneness, crazy, scruffy people on the Haight-Ashbury or psytrance, those are, you know, still going strong across the world. But at the same time, there's very different stories that are starting to gain a lot more strength in terms of the mainstream media, in terms of scientific research, in terms of individuals' careers, in terms of companies, you know, looking at, say, the use of LSD or a version of LSD to treat cluster headaches. So we start to have different sets of ideas connected to these things. They're part of healing, they're part of psychological healing, they're part of physical healing, and maybe we're looking at a situation where, as a lot of people would like, that doctors, people who are given status by the society, by institutions of learning and conformity, are given the power to be able to prescribe things for certain situations. You have PTSD, you go to a doctor, the doctor says, hey, let's do an MDMA session, or you have terminal cancer, you have a tremendous amount of anxiety, you go to a doctor, he says, look, I think it might be good to do some psilocybin in a controlled situation here, I'm going to write the script, we're going to set up the session. And, you know, this isn't happening yet, but it's something that's quite conceivable given the course of research. And, you know, I think we'd all agree here that these things can be so helpful that I think it's likely, if we're even halfway sane, which we're not always even at all sane, but if we're halfway sane, hopefully these kinds of opportunities are made available for more people. But nonetheless, when those things, you know, when you have a medical model, when you have a doctor who's prescribing, that changes really fundamentally the set and setting within which the drug has a certain kind of meaning. So it's a very interesting time to be tuning into these issues because, you know, in a way, things are up for grabs. And I'd really like to hear how you see this shift happening and what kind of consequences it might have.
So I think we have, like, a number of seven settings today, or there are always, and those depend on the different cultures in which psychedelics are utilized. But what I find encouraging is that people that are working today with psychedelics medically are much more aware of the effect of set and setting, I think. And I spoke with Rick Dublin 2-3 years ago, and he told me that when they are going to, when the FDA is going to hopefully allow a therapy with MDMA, then the set and setting is going to be prescribed part of the therapy, meaning that it will be, the drug will be allowed for use only in a specific set and setting, so that the set and setting and the psychedelic are really integrated into one another. And I think that there's also this awareness that the medical model has its own disadvantages, and that taking a trip with a doctor isn't what most people really usually have in mind when they want to go through a soul revealing experience. So I think that this is changing in a good way, that there's more like an awareness of how the experience is shaped by this thing of set and setting, and how we should be careful to avoid shaping it too much, and also how we should pay attention to those issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, so we've been talking about the medical model here, but you can also look at the other side. And again, one of the fascinating, I mean, psychedelics is such a fascinating topic regardless of whether or not you're interested in taking them. It always surprises me that more people don't pay attention to it. But one of the other things that's interesting in that's happening now is that if on the one hand we're having a stronger profile for these substances in the psychomedical model, where they're molecules that are produced and then you're taken in a kind of secular setting, and they have certain kinds of effects, and they help people through certain issues. They may help with physical things like cluster headaches as well as psychological mm-hmm. things, but it's very secular. And at the same time, we have this incredible growth of psychedelic religion, in particularly the popularity of ayahuasca in North America and Europe, but also the strength of ayahuasca religions in Brazil, which are also themselves being increasingly studied by scientists and sociologists and anthropologists, that, you know, and it's almost like the same thing. It's like once you realize that set and setting are in the room and that they're part of the experience no matter what, you're always telling a story, and that story is going to have effects, then suddenly it puts religion in a different kind of light. And we're not talking spirituality here. We're talking religion in the sense that it's a social structure. There's a group ritual. There are group stories about the nature of the entities. There are songs that are shared. There are prayers to gods. You know, it has religious density, and yet from the set and setting perspective, it looks different. And I'm curious whether you think that the religious sort of interpretation or construction of psychedelic experience is going to keep growing and intensifying, or is it going to come in conflict with these more secular models, or how do you see that relationship going on?
That's a really interesting question, because both those models are growing at the moment and becoming more acceptable, and you even have the Santo Daime Church operating in Oregon, I think, in the U.S. legally, and there are these churches that are operating legally in Europe, which is something that was really unthinkable, I don't know, 10 or 20 years ago. So I think it all is about creating the perfect set and setting, which is what Leary and his colleagues wanted to do in the 60s. They wanted to explore the possibility of creating the perfect set and setting, but there is no one perfect set and setting. The perfect set and setting depends on where you want to go and who you are and really all these issues which are part of the set and setting. So I think like both these models have their own their advantages or their virtues, and I do hope that they both that they don't come into conflict, because I think there's definitely a place for both of them, or an important role for psychedelics, both as medicines and as well as in religious rituals, where they are also, of course, medicines, but maybe in a different way.
Well, yeah. I feel like, too, one of the issues that comes up there is the doctor's participation, right? Like, I think inherent in setting up situations like that, whether or not there is some formula that you can attain that is the perfect, you know, environment and everything's just perfect and nothing will ever mm-hmm. mess it up. Of course, in the world, you know, that's never true in any situation. But that the doctors have to actually have taken the medicine. And, of course, in olden times, you know, shamans or medicine people, they would have ingested anything they would have given to anybody else. And that's through sympathy they would know what was going to happen. But do you feel like in order for this to work then, do you feel like we can just get some, you know, sort of formula? Or do you feel like inherently whoever is prescribing the medicine and going through the trip with some of the doctors, will they have had to do it themselves as well?
Well, in the 60s, this was one of the major issues, of course, that the issue of self-experimentation. And you can distinguish between two kinds of self-experimentation. The first kind is the soft kind, which is like that the doctor knows the experience, that he has experienced psychedelic. And the second one is the strong kind, is when he takes the psychedelic together with the patient during treatment. I think like...
Ah, right, right.
Right. So the first kind was actually practiced even by psychometrics scientists, and not all of them, but the first U.S. trip was taken by Dr. Robert Hyde, which was one of the originators of the psychometric paradigm in the U.S. But the strong kind was really practiced only by mostly by Leary and his group, and was criticized by many within the psychedelic community as well. So the shamanic model of in which sometimes the patient doesn't even ingest the drug, it is just the shaman. So this whole idea that the doctor is the one that takes the drug in order to heal the patient,
right.
Of course, runs totally contrary to the intuition of Western medicine. And I think that that today, from what I know of also about the programs for MDMA therapists that are happening today, that really from what I understand, the first kind of doctors that are taking psychedelics legally, not for their therapy, but in order to treat other people, so they have a better understanding of the experience, that these things are happening really right now. And so I think we're moving in the right direction, and I definitely think that without this, it would be impossible. And the role of the doctor here is really, there has to be some sort of education, because it's not... The kind of medicine that you can just give to a person and say, go home and try this at home. It has to be, yeah.
Well, wonderful. These are great questions. I look forward to talking to you more, and also talking a little bit about the Israeli scene and the magazine you're doing. And but we got to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Maja Daou and Eric Davis. We're talking with Ido Hart. How do you pronounce your last name?
Hartogzon.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here with the illustrious Eric Davis, and we're talking about psychedelics, as usual. We're speaking with Ido Hartogzon and some of his work that he's examined on how to integrate some of this stuff into traditional medicine and maybe look at it in terms of more psychological and medical uses. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about the important role of the doctor in all of this and kind of where that fits in. And I know that in American society, the situation with healthcare and the kind of like absenteeism with a lot of doctors and their participation with their patients, certainly not all of them, but obviously it's reached such a state that, you know, it's an issue in America. And I was wondering if generally in Israel, if there's just like a different mindset in terms of patient-doctor treatments, or are there similar issues over there where it's just kind of this like removal of like the humanity of it, and they're just kind of dispensing drugs?
Well, I think the situation in Israel is kind of the, in these terms, is really the worst that could be. I mean, the last times I visited the doctor, they hardly look at you. And actually, when I was in the U.S. lately, last autumn, then I visited the doctor there, and the experience was actually much better than what I know in Israel usually, maybe because it's you pay so much for it, but here in Israel they're just, you know, flooded with patients because it's a crumbling social system, sadly. And they don't and yeah, it's just the kind of anonymity and the kind of like just being a number in the system feeling is very strong.
Well, let's talk about other aspects of the scene. Like you're starting a new magazine. Talk about that and what you hope to, you know, what you hope to articulate or throw light on in terms of what's happening in Israel and the sort of progressive psychedelic culture there, and what you think that has to say maybe to people outside as well.
Well, we've started the magazine. It's the first issue just got out, and we're really excited about it. It's there hasn't been really lots of writing about psychedelics published in Hebrew. Basically, almost nothing. I mean, there's nothing of McKenna. There's nothing of Timothy Leary. There's just basically, nothing. And since most people here don't usually read Hebrew, read English, so there's like this void that. Well, it's been my privilege, and it was a lot of fun of feeling that void. I have been writing about psychedelics for the past few years in my blog, but now I'm working on this magazine with another friend, Boaz Yaniv, and we have this it's part of this greater vision of creating a kind of discourse around psychedelics in Israeli society, because lots of Israelis do psychedelics, lots of Israelis are very intense with drugs, and as you said before, and there's a big culture of trance parties, and trance music was the only kind of music that happened real live in Israel, and where Israeli artists were like part of the international scene, and every week there's like dozens of parties going on in the desert or in different illegally in nature. So it's really strong, but the kind of like more intellectual or cultural aspects of it are usually missing. So what we're trying to do is to create this space where people can come together and really write about these things. We're publishing also visionary works of art, and to create this kind of space for discussion for the community here, or something that will raise the consciousness that there is even such a thing as a community, and also to make people think or help people think about those things in a more integrative way. Our first issue has a lot of about psychedelic first help and about like intelligent use of drugs, and it was important for us to have those kind of things in the first issue, because it was like so many young people that are going into these things, and like you said, after military service, and just start going into parties, sometimes during military service, and taking acid every week, or so for us it's really important to like take the discourse into this place where this is not just something that you can like rock on, but it's also something that you can think about and talk about and experience on deeper levels.
Yeah, it's a tough problem for those of us who are, you know, creating discourse around psychedelics, because it's a kind of invulnerable place to be, because there's this whole underground world, and there's a lot of unintelligent, unfocused, dangerous use, and you know, while there's some of that is even arguably good at some point in your life, you know, it's kind of crazy, it's sort of like a rite of passage, because it's so hard to have a visible but more, you know, sort of whether you want to think about it as like intellectual or just more kind of like a community that's really visible, that shows people that there's other ways of doing it, it's a very kind of vulnerable place to be. At least, I mean, I feel it in the United States, looking around and seeing how things can go in terms of the, you know, the drug war, you know, one thing that happened recently you might know is that Jeremy Narby, who of course wrote The Cosmic Serpent, he's a anthropologist, was giving a talk in Belgium, a very mellow talk, nothing crazy, nothing you know, revolutionary by any means. And just by mentioning, sort of a quip he made about the potential value of psychedelics, he got arrested, and they're trying to, you know, get him convicted for inciting drug use. And so it's,
wow.
The discourse is at least for the way I experience it, is a little dodgy, even though it's precisely that. that needs to happen. It's not that, you know, it's not like the doctor studying how it works pharmacologically. It's creating a culture so that set and setting improve so that people can learn and grow and balance and moderate and, you know, do all that stuff. But that's not going to happen naturally in a psytrance world where these things are commodities. People are just trying to escape their lives. They're just trying to have fun. So it's a very tricky position. And I'm curious just for you, in Israel, given the politics of drugs, given the, you know, conservatives, what I really don't know, are you somewhat exposed by putting a magazine out like this? Is there a lot of support for this kind of exploration?
That's a really good question, and I ask myself the same question, and I have no way of knowing. If the same thing that happened to Leary, let's say in the 60s, just from talking about this stuff, can happen here. I guess as long as you don't put out too many waves, it can't. And I've felt this kind of like nobody's taking an interest in that from the side of the establishment, as long as, you know, you're not making too big of waves. But I've written about that in national magazines and also about my experiences. So I think there's the drug war is certainly going on in Israel, and there's also certainly a lot of people that are very open to psychedelics, especially young people. And even though the country is generally very conservative in many ways, then you even have like you have Orthodox people that are having experiences with psychedelics. So it is happening, and there is a drug war around it. But I feel it's like not on the top of the agenda for the regime. So I'm just taking my chances.
And then what other what does your larger research look like? What else are you looking at in terms of either thinking about set and setting in terms of what's happening now, or other models, other things that are concerning you now?
Well, my research has a lot to do with the kind of values that like frame the opposition to drugs. I'm very interested in why these agents cause such discomfort in the culture, and a kind of what I call hallucinophobia, this kind of like, I don't know, very primal fear that these things seem to press on these very on issues that have to do with very basic fundamental parts of the cultural psyche. And I'm interested in that, in looking at the kinds of values that came to a clash in the 60s and that are coming to into a clash right now in our perception of psychedelics. And I'm also just working on many different artistic projects, and a lot of them having to do with psychedelics. I'm finishing my PhD these days, and this is really a very, very welcome time for me. It's been like 3 years of just doing the same kind of research, and I'm like this person that likes to hop around between ideas and do different projects. So I have like this list of like 40 projects that that I want to start the moment I hand it in. So
well, that's interesting. I wonder if, like, how Eric brought up with Jeremy Narby, which is, that is ridiculous, although sadly not surprising. Have you ever had any, like, caught any flack for any of your experiments or research, or have you found, like, you're totally cool, like, you can just kind of do whatever you want and no one gives you any trouble?
So, yeah, up until now, no trouble yet, and I'm just I feel like, you know, I have to be straight in my path, and I always think, like, if something ever happens, I just look for political asylum, and and it will be, like, a good reason to move on. But, yeah, the really troubling thing is that this kind of approach, of course, is so prevalent all around the world, which is... kind of depressing.
Well, I'm curious for you, and I mean, I'm looking through the videos that you post on the site, and some of the stuff that you've done. I must say that the Intergalactic Masters course on YouTube is hilarious, and people should definitely check that out. Really, you know, really playing with a sort of very, you know, goofy, over the top, but still kind of profound, you know, expression of like the freakier side of, you know, psychedelic culture. I mean, that's one of the things that I think is interesting about, you know, taking psychedelic culture as a whole, though, as you point out, it has really very, very different varieties in it. It's like on the one hand, you have these very strongly, almost, you know, religious, intense sense of the sacred that people seek and healing and da-da-da. But there's also this kind of freaky, crazy, funny, satirical, you know, hedonic, playful, trickster kind of side that has a different, really different character. And I'm kind of curious, just in your own explorations and maybe even in the media and other kind of cultural projects that you're interested in, which side of the spectrum do you fall on?
Well, I try to fall on both sides, and I think like the first person that comes to my mind in this connection is a writer that I know you like a lot, which is Philip K. Dick, and his whole you know, mixture of on the one hand like ludicrous ideas, and on the other hand like very deep theological and religious issues, and you know, like these kind of things of you know, a revelation coming through a color, you know, like in Valis, which is pink, if I'm not mistaken. So it for me the Intergalactic Underground course that was for me at the time it came through a revelation, during a psychedelic experience, and it came complete with all the directions on how to direct it and how the shot should be framed and of course the script and everything, and it was a joke and it was totally serious at the same time, and I felt that that's like the kind of like religion that I also like the best, because I think like God is like the best joke, you know.
No, I think that's a wonderful, but that to me is in some ways the most precious transmission of psychedelic culture in the West, is that trickster, goofy but profound, that mix where you don't know where you are. And it's funny when you extrapolate from the current moment, it's easy to imagine a situation where, or it's not too hard to, where people who have genuine psychological and some physical issues can go to a doctor and get prescribed a psychedelic experience with maybe a controlled setting, you know, medicalized, you know, in terms of the psychological industry and the da-da-da secular. And on the other hand, where people who join, let's say, the Santo Daime, maybe it grows in the West, people recognize that it's a real religion, just like the Native American church with peyote, so that if you're a religious person, you can also go and you're allowed to take these things. But the middle zone, you know, the middle current, the neither in, neither out, God, you know, God is not real, but he's with you all the time. The, you know, the trickster, subgenius, that current, that's the one that's the hardest to fit into mainstream reality. And for me, that's the one that I'm most interested in kind of keeping alive. I mean, I love it all, but it's all very interesting to me. But that one, which I see coming through some of your work and some of the videos you choose, I think is a really real special kind of sacred.
I definitely understand what you're talking about, because I have a piece I once wrote, which is called Psychedelia and Entheogenia. And in it, I'm writing about these two aspects of psychedelic use. And one is this really focused aspect, of like focused way of working with these things, which is just the entheogenic way. And on the other hand, you also have the psychedelic way, which is, just chaotic and just exploring and going to weird places. And I love that. I mean, that's how I started. And sometimes today when I'm talking about, you know, the kind of like safe seven setting and those kinds of stuff, I feel sometimes, whoa, you're a bit of a liar, because my first trip was in Amsterdam and I was alone in the rain and didn't know what to do. And like, amazing stuff were happening to me, and it changed my life, because I flew in time to 1938, and I was chased by the Nazis all around Europe, and all these things that were totally crazy and didn't make sense at the time, but they were so powerful because they were so archetypal, and because they didn't need to make sense, it just left all those riddles in my mind. Those things to me are. You know, they're some of the most precious things that the psychedelic experience has to offer. So I definitely wouldn't want to give that up.
Yeah, it's funny. It's sort of like there's something about and I'm really going to. It's really going to be interesting to see how this goes forward. Is that there's something fundamentally controllable about these things. Some others, whether you think of it as mystery, whether you think about it as madness, whether you think about it as excess, whatever word you have for it, there's something that is more than any framework, more than any concept,
right,
more than any practice that's in these things. And I think that's, you find that even in the most religious use of it, there's always something more that's unexpected or something crazy or whatever. And as these things get sort of, as they find their way into society and maybe in more controllable environments, how that ultimate mystery, that ultimate excess, you know, finds its way, where does it get, you know, where does it rear its head? It's very hard, and it's really interesting watching, you know, like people like Maps and Doblin and some of these the scientists and some of the people who are like, in terms of trying to make a case for the usefulness of these things, you know, that they're useful for people to get over your psychological problems, to get over some physical problems, to incorporate them into the idea that we take drugs because they're useful to us. But even that model, they're gonna screw with that. They're gonna undermine that. The mystery is gonna swallow that up. And so how that goes through in the next decade, two decades, I'm very curious to see.
Yeah, we need to have more respect for the freaky side, you know, like the freaky isn't, it's hard to sell the freaky to this culture, and the freaky is really, it's important, you know.
But it's interesting because that's what the scientists are trying to control. It's almost like by making that environment, they're trying to discourage you from having a totally freaky experience, which is kind of like what you need to have the breakthrough. So by trying to exert that kind of control on things, they're actually decreasing, maybe, the effectiveness of being able to like have that transformation happen.
Well, maybe the freaky side has like more of a space when you look at the artistic kind of like in the artistic explorations of psychedelics. So and they're like, if you take for example Philip K. Dick, or if you take psychedelic music or psychedelic video, that there's more of a space for it. But I wonder how it would work, how it can be integrated for the general user.
Oh, if not, maybe it's not even possible. We just have a couple of minutes left, but I did want to ask you one just really briefly. Is what do you mm-hmm. think about the role that psytrance is playing globally, or even in Israel, in terms of propagating psychedelic culture now? Does it seem positive? Are there some problems? Are you concerned? How do you see it?
The role of psytrance?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a bit of a novice in the world of psytrance. I have to say, my first party was like when I was 30-something. And this summer I'm going for the first time for a major trance festival in Croatia, in less than a month with friends.
I've really heard about that one. That's good.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, you'll have to give us a report then.
Okay, yeah, definitely, from Croatia.
So we're winding up here. I want to give you a chance to tell people the various URLs and places they can find you online.
Okay, so you can search my blog, Psychedelic Cultures, which is a preface to my next book, hopefully. And, yeah, I think you can get to everything else from there. Also search for the Intergalactic Underground and maybe the Geula Party on YouTube.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. And just also, once again, the daily psychedelic video is
quite a treat
when you need that little brain break. It's amazing the things that people are doing with visual media and how deeply these things have influenced visual media. It's really quite extraordinary. So thank you very much for being with us, Ido.
Thank you so much.
All right. From Eric and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.